you want the partners to feel like they're a part of the team, you know, and that they're, that they take pride and have passion in developing the software for you.
Hello, welcome back to the show. In this episode of Smarter Outsourcing Podcast, we have the pleasure of hosting John Derbyshire, a visionary leader and serial entrepreneur who's made a great impact in the world of business process management. So good evening, John, and thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Frederick. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive in, I'd like to quickly introduce John. And so we're thrilled to have you on the show today, not just because of your impressive career and insights into business process management, but also for your unique perspective on company culture, remote work, and how millennials and Gen Z are shaping the future of work. So we'll also discuss how you built your company by working with six different providers and giving them part of your company so that all share the fruits of hard work. And so let's start with John's career. John cut his teeth at EY, where he led global consulting practice of about 1,500 people. And his experience at EY provided him with a unique understanding of how businesses operate globally and exposed him to the intricacies of cybersecurity within Fortune 500 companies. He then later founded Archer Technologies, a leading player in managing compliance and risk in the government at a time when governments and banks were moving online. And having worked with 29 of the 30 top companies and top Fortune 500 firms, John's experience is invaluable. Following Archer's acquisition by EMC Corporation in 2010, John transitioned into investing, focusing on innovative SaaS and go-to-market strategies. Today, John heads up SmartSuite, a platform that aims to simplify any business process. With over 10,000 customers worldwide and a platform available in 15 languages, SmartSuite has established itself as a pioneer in the remote-first culture with a diverse team of more than 100 developers scattered across the globe. SmartSuite is a testament to John's commitment to drive efficiency within organizations, no matter the size or industry. John, did I forget anything that would make the listeners understand more about you before we dive into a few questions?
I don't think so. That was quite the introduction there. You make me feel a little old listening to all of that.
Well, no, I think it was. I think it's great to put the setup for people to understand that you've had such an interesting career and that shaped how you think about the new business that you've started. And speaking of that, you kind of went a little bit differently than most startups, I believe, at least the ones that we see with Arcanis. So you started a comprehensive product at SmartSuite instead of an MVP. So how did this approach shape your go-to-market strategy and also the company's growth trajectory? I'd be really interested in knowing a bit more about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. So when we had the idea for SmartSuite, you know, the first thing that we thought about was, you know, do we build a typical MVP that would maybe be 30% of what the product could provide? And then we begin to iterate with our initial customers to get it closer to the 90, 95% of what they need. And what we determined was that that's just not the best approach for the type of product that we were trying to build, because if we could only solve 30% of the problem, it wasn't going to solve any problem for any of our customers. And SmartSuite, the goal of SmartSuite is to provide a single platform to manage any business process or project inside of an organization. So it's a pretty big lift of features that need to be in place to allow companies to do that. From teams of two people to thousands of people, we wanted to be able to support. So the first thought process was, we can't do a traditional MVP. We need to spend the first year, year and a half to build a core platform, get us closer to the 80, 85% mark that was there. And how we achieved that was, you know, we first set out to find the development teams that we wanted to work with to help build the platform over that period of time. I never expected that I would work outside of the US so quickly, but what happened was, as I was doing my research, I found one particular resource in the Ukraine, of all places, that I kept coming back to and having great conversations with, that have built some platforms like this in the past that I thought would be the great entry point for our product. So I went to visit him in Kiev, and after 3 days, I realized that I had found the right team and person to lead that team to kind of kick off the initial development that we were going to do there. And I'll save some of that for later in this conversation. But how that approach affected our go-to-market strategy was that we built a fully functional product before we went to market with our first customer. We decided to take a product-led growth approach, meaning that users would come to our website, sign up for a free 14-day trial. At the end of that trial, they could convert to either a free plan or one of our three paid plans that were there. So our marketing outreach was very focused on driving people to the website, educating them about the product, and then allowing them to make a purchase decision if the product was right for them. And we initially did that by looking at three of the more established players in the broader project management and business process automation spaces that were mainly influencers creating content for those organizations and had built careers around creating that content. We went to each one of them independently and said, hey, we're a new player in the space. We'd love to have you come in, take our product for a test drive, and then share the results back into your channel compared to the product that you're using now, whether that was Airtable, Monday, or ClickUp, were the three big ones. And what we wanted to happen and what did happen was that each of them came back and said, we're more impressed than we thought we would be looking at a younger company like yourself. And each of them actually changed their business model to include SmartSuite in addition to the product that they were working with. And that created our initial a couple hundred videos kind of coming from a whole series of influencers that began to drive people to the website, compares against other players in the space that then led to a lot of signups. That was a pretty long-winded answer. But
yeah, no, it's cool. It's pretty cool. And so it led me to another question is, because a lot of companies, when they go with an MVP or something like that, is they want to test the waters, right? They just go out and look at the traction, and then some of them pivot because the product is not quite ready or doesn't answer to all of the needs of the client. So the strategy you had must have been like, you must have been really sure about what you were doing and that you would get traction from that. So did you do a lot of research before that? Or your idea was super clear based on your, you know, experience that this would be a hit?
Yeah, I think it was two or three things that kind of came together at once that we did. The first was that just based on my background, I'd been in the no-code space for 25 years. I'd built a company called Archer Technologies as a no-code platform and sold it in 2010. That's very successful today. And in that company, we worked with mainly Fortune 100 companies to automate processes around risk and compliance, but we could help them manage any process in their company, right? So I had a pretty good understanding of the feature set needed to do that. And we had a couple of customers, large banks in New York, that when I went to visit them in 2008 or 9, one was JP Morgan Chase, and they had built over 200 other business processes on our platform, in addition to the 9 core processes that we had around risk and compliance. So that idea was in my head for a long time of helping businesses manage any process. And when we sold SmartSuite, the company that purchased it, EMC, came back and said, we don't want to go after this broader market. We want to stay in the risk and compliance space that's there. So they kind of carved off a piece and went that direction. And I went into investing for a period of time, invested in a lot of startups and entrepreneurs. And one of the key themes that I was hearing from that group was they needed help understanding what products you use to manage processes in the business. So I did that for 5 or 6 years, and I heard that consistent theme. So when we started SmartSuite, the idea was really take from the knowledge I had from the no-code space initially, the knowledge that I gained working with so many entrepreneurs, and then I did my research. Once I felt like I understood the problem, I looked at the top 20 players kind of across a whole bunch of categories that were kind of adjacent to the no-code project management, business process automation space. I tracked about 400 data points across each one of those. So I spent about 3 months just doing the research. And I was just trying to understand, if what I wanted to build, where it kind of came out in compared to the other products, and how we might be able to price a product like that kind of in the space. And once all of that was done, then we set out for the very first time to actually write our first line of code and start working on Smart Suite.
Yes. Okay, cool. And speaking of that, you mentioned that you had six different providers. And so could you discuss the role of your strategy to go with these six different providers to build, a diverse and remote first development team in shaping your business? And
sure.
How does it work with different providers, like the daily interactions between them or between the teams? How does this all work?
Sure. Yeah. The original idea with Smart Suite was that we thought at the time it was kind of a novel idea. And it was maybe 4 months before COVID hit when we started this. But it was, instead of building a business like I had done in the past, where you have a fixed geography, where you have a headquarters, and you typically hire people 30 miles around that location to come to work each day in that same location, we thought we want to hire the best people we can find anywhere in the world with a remote first type of mentality. But at the same time, Smart Suite was going to be built in 15 languages. So we wanted to find interesting people around the world that could help bring their own perspective back to the product, so that it wasn't just a US-centric product that, you know, I built over and over in the past. So when we started that journey, I started to talk a little bit about it. I found a development firm, Gearheart, in Ukraine. They were based in Kyiv, and went and met with them. It was not my intention to want to hire them. I thought that I would hire a U.S. firm to kind of kick things off, but I kept coming back to this one individual that was there, and created a really great relationship with him and his team. And he has a development agency. It was an agency of maybe 30, 40 people. And over the next 6 months, we got him to move away from all of his other client projects and have the entire team kind of focused on Smart Suite. And that allowed us to do a couple of things with being able to have that group of people as a startup, in that it brought us skill sets that were pretty broad across a lot of different technologies that we were using. And as we were evaluating the technology stack to use a Smart Suite, we could bring in experts on different technologies, and that it worked with customers to kind of help us understand the good and the bad of each technology as we rounded out the architecture that was there. And I'll fast forward a bit. We work with two additional large development houses that are maybe 300 people in one and maybe 150 in the other. And the value that that brings to us as a startup is that when we need to go build specific types of features or technology in our product, we can typically go and find experts inside of those organizations and bring them onto our core team for some period of time, where they can bring their expertise, share that with our core team, help us make some key decisions. And then maybe they go back away after 6 months, but we keep our core team in place that's there. So from my perspective, the value as a business owner is that I can bring in that high powered expertise as needed, but I don't have to pay for it long term. And I could use that to transition knowledge to the team during that time period. So we use that quite often. Every couple of weeks, we're tapping into different types of resources. Most recently, it's been related to AI and bringing in resources that focus full time just on AI to help us build our initial models and understand how we want to move into allowing AI inside of Smart Suite. And then they begin to step away after the core teams are kind of trained to use that. And it's just been a great, great experience for us.
Great. And how have your investments in various companies shaped that perspective on running Smart Suite and the key lessons you have taken from these experiences?
Yeah, so I've had the luxury, after we sold Smart Suite, that we started a family foundation and an incubator where we bring in people with startup ideas and work with them over a period of year or years to kind of begin to bring that idea to market. And then at the same time, invested in about 400 total startups through either direct investments or through venture funds that I was involved with that was there. So I had the chance to really see a lot of different types of companies, both successful and not successful, and kind of understand some of the whys on why some were successful over others that were there, and wanted to kind of bring that mentality kind of into Smart Suite. And the first thing that we saw that was key with the successful companies were the was the core group of people that were involved in that startup initially. And if you got that right and you had the right group of people and they had an understanding of their roles, the chances of success were much higher than, you know, having founders that were always in conflict or founders that had the same skill set and they didn't, they were missing skill sets in the business that neither one of them or even three of them, you know, could provide. So a lot of it was around the people that we focused on first. And then second was the culture in the business. And that was something that we wanted to build into Smart Suite, into the product, was how to promote culture back to companies that use our product. But we also knew that culture was very key to Smart Suite. And to kind of answer the second part of the question back that I failed to do is that the way that we interact with each of the groups and teams that we work with each day is we have people in 9 countries. I start off each morning at either 6 or 6:30 my time with a series of calls, typically 3, each one 30 minutes, where I touch each of those core teams that's there. And every other day, I touch pretty much every person on the development product side of the company during those phone calls, following more of an agile approach with kind of stand-ups that are there. And then I spend about a half hour in addition to that working with our core product designer who's in Bulgaria that's there. And that sets the stage when I meet with them in the morning, they're at the end of their day and we're setting the stage and talking about what's been completed, answering any questions for the next day for that particular group that's there. And then they're ready to go and begin to work, you know, overnight to have the call the next day for. So that cadence for me personally has worked out really well.
Yeah, it kind of never stops, does it? And so you were hinting at the unique culture that Smart Suite has, and it's like built into the product, right? It encourages collaboration, and especially among millennials and Gen Z. So could you discuss a bit more about the design process behind this and how it has impacted the user experience and engagement?
Sure. Yeah, I think that, you know, as I get older and I look back through my career, you begin to understand that people in their 20s and early 30s are the people in organizations that do most of the work, right? They're doing the day-to-day things that are happening in the organization. And then you have managers that are in their 30s and 40s and older that are managing people and processes that have input into things, but they're not doing the work typically. So the thought process behind Smart Suite was we wanted to build a product that helped people manage any process in their business, and think of managing sales, marketing, HR, product, all those different types of workflows in one platform that is connected. That's what Smart Suite is all about. But doing it in a way that millennials and Gen Zers are used to in the way that they've been, you know, kind of grown up with technology. What I mean by that is, you know, they've been on social media and had phones in their hands, you know, from the time they could hold a phone, some of them that's there. Very different than my generation that was there. And so they expect that their work experience is very collaborative in nature, and that they want to know a couple of things that we found out as we kind of did our research. The first was that especially millennials wanted to know the why. They're very focused on, I want to understand the goals and objectives of the company, whether it's for the year or the quarter. And I want to buy into those values that are associated with those. And if I don't agree, that's probably not the job for me, and I'll probably move on pretty quick. Right. So we try to do a good job of making things transparent where they can see those and understand where things are at. But what was even more important was the ability to collaborate with other people that they work with. And by collaborate, basically, I mean a Facebook or Twitter type of component inside of a product where if I want to have a conversation with you, Frederick, in the context of the work that I'm doing, maybe I'm working on a particular task. It's like a personal Slack channel right for that task, where I could see a history of things, or I could see what you're working on and high five you or flag you to kind of say, hey, great job that you're doing here. They also wanted the ability to have like a member directory where they could see the people in the company with their profiles. They can search and see where people are located. Like they wanted to feel a part of the company that was there. And I could go on for 15 minutes on all the types of features that we've built in like that into the product, but it's really been geared towards millennials, Gen Zers that want to have a little bit different of a work experience. And from a UI perspective, we also found that they like rich colors and really, you know, vivid fonts, a little bit bigger, like things that are engaging as they're working. They don't want a software product that I often say that this isn't your dad's software, meaning when I grew up, the software was just software. It wasn't meant to build culture, to collaborate. You just did your work. Screens didn't look great, but it wasn't very engaging. You just did your work. The Smart Suite software is meant to be engaging and to have the people actually enjoy what they're doing because it's visually pleasing. So we've spent a tremendous amount of time on the UI, and that's where I love to spend the bulk of my time working with our designer, our core designer, each day on what we're learning, what we're changing, you know, down to the pixel, you know, level, down to one point size on font over another point size.
Yeah, that's cool. And I'm thinking, you mentioned you didn't want just a US-centric company, right? And you talked about the generations. And the other question is, like, how did you embed the different cultures of the companies or the customers you may be targeting into that UI or that experience for users?
Yeah. The first thing I did, this was very purpose-driven in that I wanted to find a designer that wasn't in the US, and I wasn't sure where I was going to find them to start, but I didn't want to build what I'd always built before with a user interface and just have just another product that's in the space. Like, I wanted somebody that would think a little differently and would actually push me on the design side. And I started with three designers that I had found kind of around the world. And one of them just kind of came to the top, you know, pretty quickly. He happened to be in Sofia, Bulgaria. So I went to Bulgaria and met with him. And we had a great time, great relationship, worked together really well. And his name is Stoygen. And Stoygen he has a passion for great UI, and it bothers him. Like, it personally bothers him if things are just not perfect, right? And he wants to continue to work and get feedback and understand, like, the why, compared to getting frustrated that we may go through seven designs for a page and, you know, the fifth one is almost as good as the seventh one. And in Sorgan's case, like, he wants to keep going until we feel like we've nailed what the customer wants to see in the way that they do their work. And then we want to minimize the amount of clicks that it takes to actually do an action. So once we figure out the feature set and how all needs to fit together and the outcome that we need, we then focus on the visualization side. And then how can we, you know, cut down this from maybe five steps to three clicks, you know, to be able to do that.
And one follow-up question, you mentioned about your designer being super passionate. And I have the feeling that when you also mentioned about visiting the first provider you've started working with in Ukraine, that you built a personal relationship. So how did you end up choosing these people? Was it the passion for what they were doing, the questions they were asking you when you were maybe laying out the ideas of your product? What was the element that made you, you know, decide to get on with different of these providers?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm old enough now, and I say this quite often, is that I want to work with people I enjoy working with, and I'm kind of in a unique position to be able to do that. And my first one is, if I don't want to go out and have a drink with them or go to dinner or lunch, that's a red flag to me. Like, I want to work with people that I want to continue those discussions after work with. Once I'm satisfied that they technically understand the job, whether that was the initial developers or Stoygen on the design side, it really came down to that relationship that we had. Like, can we build a personal relationship that we can challenge each other, talk through things each day, and that's not going to be stressful or create a lot of anxiety for us? We feel comfortable with each other to be able to do that. That's there. So for, you know, 9 out of 10 people that I hire, I try to take that particular tact in that I don't want to say that they're not good people if I don't hire them. I want to find the right people that kind of fit into Smart Suite, the culture that we want to create, and that we can have an easy conversation between us and them with our other associates as well.
Yeah, I agree. That's also how we choose to work with the companies we work with. It's an alignment in values and easy conversations. And I think the mindset of doing great things together, as partners rather than a simple provider client relationship. And speaking of that, so with your partner, you have a bit of a novel idea back then, which was to have them work. I don't know if it's fully or partly for equity, but by doing this, you probably wanted to increase their engagement in what they do. And we also understand that because at Arcanis Ventures, we do the same. So we invest software development services from our team for equity. So we're just on the other side, but it's the same mindset. And so if you could discuss a little bit why you chose this business model, why it works for you, and why do you think it's the future for startups?
Yeah, I think there's a couple big reasons that are in here. You know, the first one is you want to work with people if you're kind of going to this remote first concept, and a concept of working with partners, especially on the development side. You want the partners to feel like they're a part of the team, you know, and that they're, that they take pride and have passion in developing the software for you. It's not just, I work 8 to 5 and I go away, right? Which that works in some cases, but we wanted more than that. Like we wanted them to really help drive the product forward. And by allowing our partners to take a portion of their fees in equity, and it's completely up to them, what they take. And we have some rules and some limits kind of around that for them. And we also allow them to, you know, so that's each invoice that they would send, they could take a percentage of that invoice in equity if they wanted. We also had a couple points where we said, hey, if you would like to take more, you could take an entire month or two of fees in equity. And when we did that, it was great to see that all four people we were working with at that time went forward with that. And that made us feel really good that we had found the right partners. They were really invested in what we were trying to accomplish and felt part of the team, not just, you know, a developer that was a contractor working for us. You know, it was more of a relationship that we were building. And for startups, you know, the value for a startup is that you need to get stuff done fast. And one of the hardest parts of getting started as a tech startup is hiring your technical team. Right, and understanding what resources to hire, what level, who reports to who. Like you could spend months just trying to figure that out and just hire people. What's great when you find the right partners, especially if they have a larger team, and I know your team is around 300, where you can go and say, this is what I need to accomplish. These are the types of resources that I need. You may say, hey, our core team is 8 people. We can bring in some heavy experts in these particular areas for a short amount of time. Do it at a really reasonable rate that maybe is even better than the rates that could be done, you know, that we could hire people locally in the US for this there. So it's kind of a win-win both on the cost perspective and on just finding good resources to kind of get things kicked off for your company. And some startups may decide that over time, you know, they're going to feel more comfortable bringing more development talent in-house. What I think is going to happen and what's going to begin to change in the industry is that you're going to have some people in-house, but you're going to have the vast majority of your resources at 2 or 3 partners that you really trust, that you can, again, bring in the types of resources you need as needed. It's just very efficient.
So because you've seen so many, you've invested in so many startups, right? And most of them are in need of technical resources. So you mentioned that when you started, with SmartSuite by having these vendors potentially work for equity. Have you seen that trend kind of go on as you started? Because you mentioned that you thought it's the future for startups. So have you seen that kind of take on and startups adopting that model?
Yeah, I have. So when we back in the days where I'd started an incubator, we were starting to work with or more technology companies that needed development resources. We had found talent in the local area that we had kind of pooled together that would work with these various startups. And that was the time when I first started to understand the value of bringing somebody in that's built software at other customers with different types of architectures that could bring some pretty immediate knowledge, you know, back. So with SmartSuite, the idea was to, you know, really tap into that. And as I was investing in companies towards the end, I started to see more US-based companies beginning to outsource and not considering outsourcing a bad thing and not doing it just to save money, doing it because of the value that it brought back to the company long term. And there, you know, there's another side of this as well, in that, you know, hiring resources directly and trying to manage those resources. Let's say that maybe you have 20 developers that you've hired directly in different locations. That can be challenging, right, to build that culture with that team. What I found as well as working with partners is they get the culture from their local team in addition to from us. So a lot of care and feeding and career development happens inside of the partner. And that's the part that I think, and I can speak mainly for US startups in the SaaS side that I've worked with. You know, I don't talk to too many founders that aren't working with some international development talent at this point.
Yeah. Okay. That's the same trend as we see. Well, thank you, John. It's been a really, really super interesting conversation, understanding kind of the other side of what we are seeing as a, you know, as a development company, hearing the story from you building an amazing business with six different providers. I think it has probably needed a good conductor skills, like you're directing an orchestra with different cultures, amongst different providers, different cultures also amongst the countries you're working in. So how have you managed to work over these cross cultures? Maybe some of the teams also are working together. How did you manage that?
Yeah, I say that's been like a value add. It's not been something that we've had to worry about. It's been on the other side, in that when we get on our calls as a company each morning, you know, there are times we have six or seven different countries on that call at the same time. And we've been doing it now for quite some time, and everybody has become friends. And it's just interesting to have, you know, friends in whether they're Bulgaria or the Ukraine or Spain or UK or Latin America, like just all these different people kind of coming together. And you realize a couple of things. The first is people are just people, regardless of where they're located. You know, they're just good, interesting, fun people to hang out with. And most of them don't have a lot of biases. They just like to interact with folks. And for me, it makes my job a lot more interesting to have the perspective from all these different people kind of coming in. And our workforce, the majority of them are probably 22 to maybe 34, 35. They kind of fit in the Gen Z millennial space as well. So they're helping share a perspective that's different than my generation perspective, which helps me better understand, you know, how to build features into our product specifically for that group. But I'll just say that the bottom line for us is that it's been a net positive to be able to work with people and with different cultures. And we haven't thought about it as, you know, something that was hard to do on our side.
That makes me think of a bonus question for you. A lot of the big companies now who went completely remote with COVID are now calling a bunch of people back to the office, mentioning that, you know, it's been difficult for the company culture, for cohesion, for maybe even collaboration. And so are you solely remote, or do you have people meet, I don't know, once a year or something like that? Or how? What's your thinking around that?
Yeah, so it's been kind of a difficult time for us with getting everybody together because COVID hit. And then everything was happening for a couple of years. And then the war in Ukraine hit, where we have a large number of people across two different providers that were there. The men can't leave the country that's there. Yeah. So it's been hard for us to physically get together. Now, a lot of people outside of that have been able to get together, but we haven't been able to get everybody together. But my personal perspective on what we're finding is that the people that really need to be in an office more are on the marketing side and the sales side, where they need to have collaboration and work on things together for, you know, all day. That's there. Very different than development, where people need to understand their priorities, and it's a lot of developers actually enjoy a little bit of conversation at the beginning of the day, a little bit at the end of the day, but they have time to just go get their work done. Like they enjoy that time, not be distracted. And they're more productive is what we found. And the same with, so our development team, our QA team, some of our requirements analysts, even kind of our release manager, those folks do really well in a remote setting. And our core marketing and sales folks, we have them spread out a little bit, but we're starting to kind of build a hub to bring, to have the bulk of those people so they could have those connections. Those people are mainly, they're very extroverted and they want to be in conversation with people and interacting the majority of their day.
We feel the same, right? I'm in charge of growth, so sales and marketing and meeting and creativity is very important, and sharing the experiences. And with developers, we still feel a bit of the need to meet, but as you said, it's less so because there's a big need of being uninterrupted and having the ability to concentrate on problem solving for a big part of the day. And developers, I don't want to stereotype, but in a lot of cases are slightly more introverted than the extroverted sales and marketing people, as a general rule. I feel like I could ask you a ton more questions, because it's really interesting understanding how you've built your business. But I guess we can stop here for today. And so thank you very much for sharing, you know, your experience and how you see the culture and how you try to embed this in your business, how you also involve your providers and see them as your partners, really, for, you know, to get to the success you'd like to achieve. And so now I'm sure that many of our listeners would like to get in touch with you, John. And so could you please share with the audience how they could get in touch with you if they have questions or just want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple ways. Pick which one is best for you. But most people reach out to me on LinkedIn and just send me a direct message there, or even comment on one of the posts, whether that's for me personally or through SmartSuite on our LinkedIn channel there. And that's a great way for us to build a connection. If you're using our product or you're starting a trial, in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a little icon. And when you click on that, it opens up a modal where you can talk with a member of our team live. And in there, you could just say, hey, I want to have a conversation with John about this topic. And those messages get forwarded right to me as well. Yeah, cool. And if you're interested in SmartSuite, we'd love to have you just come to our website, smartsuite.com, and take a peek and start a free 14-day trial, no credit card required. And even if this product's not for you, we'd love feedback, good or bad. So feel free to pass on your thoughts if you do a trial.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. I really wish you the best in your endeavor with SmartSuite. And to our listeners, thank you for your time and support. That means a lot to us. So if you like today's topic, please don't forget to give us a great rating. And until next time, thank you for tuning in. Stay curious and keep learning. See you.